and welcome to the talking news for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, May the 24th, 2025. I do hope you're all well. The music you're hearing is Fig Leaf Rag by Scott Joplin, who pretty much invented ragtime music in the early 20th century. Something of a revival took place around 50 years ago when The Sting, a light-hearted gangster movie with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, took Joplin's The Entertainer as its theme. Have a listen to Fig Leaf Rag and see what you think. A couple of other musical surprises later in the programme, one of which is a suggestion from a listener. Don't forget, if you have a favourite song or piece you'd like to hear on the programme, do send your request in the red pack with the USB drive when you return it, and I'll do my best to track it down and play it. This week, as always, we start off with the news stories from the Hearts Advertiser. This will be followed by the radio listings and the audio described TV listings. 10 Today is up next, our series of gentle exercise routines to help keep you moving at home. Then we have a number of events this week in history, which will be followed by some famous birthdays. Then we'll have a musical interlude to be followed by Sounds of Nature, this week recorded by Simon Elliott in the North Pennines. Following this will be a fascinating interview with one of our listeners, a remarkable lady called Olga Hopkins, who recounts her wartime experiences as a wireless mechanic in the WAF. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Caroline, Lucy, Bob, and Sarah.
Hello, this is Caroline, and my first story today is about fly tipping. Fly tipper must pay £2,600. Waste, including an old sofa dumped on a quiet country road. A fly tipper has been ordered to pay more than £2,600 after a large amount of waste was dumped on a quiet country road. St Albans City and District Council's Environmental Enforcement Team spotted the fly tip at Drop Lane, Park Street, during a routine inspection of the area. Among the rubbish were wooden pallets, an old sofa, plastic packaging, bottles and takeaway food bags. The name of Masood Hussain of Hague Close, St Albans, was found on some of the material. When interviewed by council officers, he refused to make any comment and was later issued with a court summons. Hussain pleaded not guilty to failing to properly disposing of the waste, a duty of care offence under the Environmental Protection Act. He told St Albans Magistrates Court that he had merely ordered some garden items for a project overseen by a relative and was not involved in the disposal of the waste. After a short trial, magistrates found him guilty and ordered him to pay a £375 fine, a victim surcharge of £150, and a £2,163 contribution to the council's legal costs, a total of £2,668. Following the hearing on Monday, May the 12th, Councillor Anthony Rowlands, lead for recycling and waste, said, "I am pleased that our environmental enforcement team has achieved another successful prosecution. I know that fly tipping greatly annoys our residents. It is not only an eyesore and a blight on the landscape, but also a potential health hazard and is costly to clear up. This prosecution will remind people that fly tipping is a criminal offence and that can result in large fines and even a jail term in the most serious cases. It also shows that we are determined to track down offenders and deal with them appropriately."
Hello there, this is Lucy, and it's great to be reading for you again today. The first story that we have is about two nurseries who have been ranked in the East's top 20. A Margate nursery has been named in the top 20 in the region by a well-known review website. The Woodlands Nursery at Beechwood Park School are proud to be included in the list revealed by daynurseries.co.uk, one of the UK's leading nursery directory websites. The prestigious recognition is based on parent reviews and feedback from families. Woodlands received glowing feedback from families praising the nurturing atmosphere, inspiring outdoor setting and the commitment of staff to each child's development. Head of the nursery, Zoe Pritchard, said, "We are absolutely delighted to receive this recognition. It's a testament to the hard work, passion and dedication of our entire team, who create such a warm, welcoming and inspiring environment for every child who comes through our doors. We are also incredibly grateful to our parents and carers for their kind words and continued support." Sam McIntosh, head of pre-prep and nursery, added, "This award is so richly deserved. Our team at Woodlands Nursery are some of the most talented and dedicated professionals I've ever had the pleasure to work with." Woodlands Nursery is located within the grounds of Beechwood Park School. And St Albans Mount Carmel Kindergarten at Kinder Lodge was also named in the East of England Top 20 list.
Hello, it's Bob here. Plans for former home base site. Home Bargains submits plans for new store. Home Bargains has submitted plans for a new store in St Albans after years of shoppers hoping it would come to the city. A planning application made on behalf of Home Bargains earmarks the former home base unit in Hatfield Road for a new store. The St Albans DIY and Garden Centre branch shut in March and has since been left vacant, with new options like home tool shops, gyms and mini outlets, all suggested by our readers. Documents attached to the plans show a comprehensive refurbishment of the building and layout, comprising a new shop front, sprinkler tank, pump house, trolley shelter and associated works. The applicant believes that the proposal contributes positively, quote unquote, to the St Albans area and, quote unquote, secures long-term occupation of the existing retail unit. The proposed store, when opened, would retain or generate up to 100 full and part-time job opportunities, a supporting statement reads. The high-quality modern retail unit and shop fit-out proposed will result in additional investment in the local economy. TJ Morris Limited, which trades as Home Bargains, promises an investment exceeding £3 million into the shop. Home Bargains do not currently operate in the St Albans area, with the nearest store in Stevenage, Waltham Abbey and Watford. The unit's previous occupier, Homebase, shut its Alban Park location as part of closures nationwide. At the time, a spokesman for Homebase said, "We have announced 16 stores confirmed for closure in March. Affected team members have been given notice of their effective date of redundancy by their employee representative and store manager, followed by confirmation letters sent to their home address. A decision date is yet to be confirmed for the plans that are currently subject to public consultation until June the 13th.
Hello, I'm Sarah. New banners and bunting celebrating city's history. New banners have been spotted across St Albans High Street, but what do they represent? St Albans Business Improvement Districts, or BID, has launched a new initiative named Residents of Verulamium, featuring themed summer banners in the city centre. These can be found along St Peter's Street, with new bunting also recently erected across French Row, Waddington Road and George Street. Installed by Bay Media and High Level Electrics, the banners and bunting incorporate the colours of the Enjoy St Albans branding, which is the district's official visitor brand. A spokesperson for St Albans BID said, "Displaying the St Albans history front and centre, the BID gives a nod to the ancient residents of Verulamium for this summer's St Peter's Street lamp columns. Each character has a backstory, which may not be so different from the residents of today. Their backstories will be attached to the columns underneath each banner over the next couple of weeks. The installation of banners and the bunting are part of St Albans City Centre BID's delivery of the street scene and experience objective, with the aim to create a more inviting and vibrant atmosphere by adding interest and a burst of colour to the city centre.
Fireworks Company celebrates 40 years. A fireworks company that started as a sideline at weddings has celebrated its 40th anniversary. Fantastic Fireworks, founded by John Culverhouse in 1985, has grown from a small venture in Redbourne to a leading name in the UK fireworks industry. The company has staged more than 10,000 displays both in the UK and abroad. It has also won the British Fireworks Championship twice and continues to organise displays in Redbourne and St Albans. In May, the company celebrated its 40th anniversary with a party at Brockett Hall near Welwyn. John paid tribute to the clients and employees who have contributed to the company's success. Colin Bryan, former managing director of Drayton Manor Theme Park, recalled how his father was sceptical about spending £5,000 on their first fireworks display in 1990. He said, "When 10,000 people showed up to watch, he had to eat humble pie. We used fantastic fireworks every year from then on." John's interest in fireworks was sparked by family bonfire parties. He started making his own fireworks with the help of his school chemistry lab. However, his passion had to be put on hold when he started a career in journalism. A chance encounter with Chinese fireworks in a shop window in 1983 reignited his interest. An article he wrote for the Daily Mail about the fireworks led to the importer sending him a large box of fireworks as a thank you. This led to the birth of Fantastic Fireworks a year later. John said, "I didn't know anyone in the industry and very little about the world of professional fireworks, but here we were, new kids on the block, blowing our trumpet." The company has achieved significant success over the years, including staging London's first New Year's Eve display in 1997 and a £250,000 display for Liverpool's 800th anniversary in 2008. John said, "It has been a fantastic journey, but I couldn't have achieved it without the dedication, commitment and professionalism of the amazing staff it has been my pleasure and honour to work with, and all the hundreds of clients who put their faith in Fantastic Fireworks." And there is a photo of John next to his Aston Martin car holding a load of rockets. The car has a registration plate 5NOV for the 5th of November. And in the background, there is a wonderful display of fireworks.
Our next article has a very intriguing title. Friends both strike silver at Marmalade Awards. Two friendly rivals from a quiet Harpenden and cul-de-sac are now the toast of the town after scooping silver medals at the World Marmalade Awards. The prestigious Dalemain World Marmalade Awards in Cumbria celebrate all things zesty, and Catherine and Adrian, who both live on the same street, have been universally recognised. Their success comes in the 20th anniversary year of the competition, which this year saw more than 3,000 entries from across the world. "We couldn't believe it," said Catherine. "We were both delighted to receive and share our scores and certificates." While they each entered last year and have been quietly competitive ever since, this year the pair achieved a silver award each and unofficially renamed their cul-de-sac Marmalade Muse. Both Catherine and Adrian credit their triumph in part to the wonderful produce they picked up from Carpenter's Nursery in Sandridge, where their fruit journey began. Adrian added, "It's the kind of neighbourly rivalry you don't mind losing, especially when you're both winners. But make no mistake, it's gold or bust next year." The Dalemain Awards has been likened to the Olympics of the preserve world, drawing amateur and professional jam makers to submit their creations in dozens of categories.
Resurfaced tennis courts reopened. Greenwood Park Tennis Club has reopened its newly resurfaced courts. The club, located in Chiswell Green, invited the community for an open day on its new high-quality carpet courts. Mayor Jamie Day and former mayor and ex-High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Annie Brewster, officially cut the ribbon, marking the reopening of the three out of the club's five courts. The pair highlighted the club's role in promoting sport, inclusivity and participation. Children and adults had the opportunity to try out the new courts, engaging in various tennis activities. Coaches, led by Sam Pink, encouraged children as young as three to join in, while older attendees also enjoyed the sport. The club reported a turnout of over 100 people, all enjoying the welcoming atmosphere. The newly resurfaced courts provided by Playwright were laid by ETC. Greenwood Park Tennis Club, located off Tippendall Lane, is now inviting more people to experience the new courts. Further information about the club can be found on their website or on their Facebook and Instagram pages. The club is keen to promote participation in tennis and offers a supportive environment for all ages. And there's a very nice sunny photograph showing the cutting of the ribbon with Mayor Jamie Day and Annie Brewster.
School head shortlisted for an award. A St Albans head teacher is delighted to be nominated as the best in the country for 2025. Mrs Waite, a St Albans High School for Girls, has been shortlisted for Head Teacher of the Year Independent in the TES Schools Award. The awards celebrate individuals' and schools' achievements with colleagues and the wider community, giving them national recognition for their hard work and successes. Mrs Waite was the head teacher of St Albans High School for Girls from 2019 to 2024, before taking up the role of principal of the St Albans Education Group, of which the High School for Girls is a flagship school, last summer. "I'm delighted to have been shortlisted for this wonderful award," she'd said. "Being head of St Albans High School for Girls was a great honour, and I'm immensely proud of what I was able to achieve during my tenure, with the support of an exceptional team of staff." A panel of judges will announce the winners of the TES Schools Award 2025 on Friday, June the 20th, at the Grosvenor Hotel, Park Lane, London. The ceremony is hosted by presenter and comedian Tom Allen.
New Indian restaurant set to open. An authentic Indian restaurant, crafted with love and spice, is set to open in St Albans. Grand Cholas has arrived in Hatfield Road, adding another eatery to its ever-growing offering. Interior works seem to be ongoing, while a sign in the shop window suggests Grand Cholas is opening soon. The restaurant will take over from Zafran One at 254 Hatfield Road, offering flavourful curries and traditional sweets from India and South India. An Instagram post has announced the upcoming launch, saying it is thrilled to bring authentic flavours to the heart of St Albans. The post read, "From crispy dosas and aromatic biryanis to flavourful curries and traditional sweets, every dish at Grand Cholas is crafted with love and spice. Join us for a dining experience that celebrates the heritage, warmth and royal taste of India. Whether you're craving a comforting meal or planning a family feast, we're here to serve you the best of Indian hospitality," the post added. An opening date is yet to be confirmed. Nearby, works have begun at the old toll house, formerly the Rat's Castle, ahead of its summer reopening.
A rather shocking story next about a pair who stole £3,000 worth of goods from Sainsbury's. A pair of thieves have been convicted after stealing more than £3,000 of goods from a London Coney supermarket. Gabriella Iliutsa, 19, and Virel Buriana, 21, both of Court Parade, Wembley, were fined at St Albans Magistrate Court on May the 6th, having indicated they were guilty of theft from the same shop. Ilyutsa was accused of stealing a selection of store goods from Sainsbury's at Coney Fields Retail Park, totalling £2,011.20 on April the 16th. She was fined £500 and the court ordered her to pay £85 in addition to a £100 surcharge. Meanwhile, Buriana was accused of stealing a selection of goods to the value of £1,134.37 at the same Sainsbury's supermarket on April the 16th. She was also fined £500 and ordered to pay court costs of £85 with a £100 surcharge.
Works to revamp the Rat's Castle. Pub to open as the Old Toll House. Construction works are underway outside an historic St Albans pub ahead of its extensive makeover. But what is next for the boozer? Scaffolding can be seen outside the former Rat's Castle in Hatfield Road as maintenance continues since its closure on April the 18th. A new image shows the iconic Rat's Castle sign has been taken down to be replaced by new The Toll House branding. Last Thursday afternoon, May the 15th, the Old Toll House Facebook page posted an update video showing the team's progress on its interior. An Old Toll House darts team will also be set up once the venue reopens. Prior to its closure, the pub was acquired by Carling franchisee Star Pubs and is set to become a sports-focused establishment by the summer. A statement on Star Pubs' website says the Rat's Castle has long stood as a testament to the town's rich history, blending a traditional British pub with the enduring spirit of the local community. The company aims to refurbish the pub to host up to 19 internal covers and 24 external covers, also adding a smart dispense system to help serve quality draft beer and cider. A spokesman for Star Pubs told the Hearts Advertiser, "We are planning a refurbishment of the Rat's Castle in 2025 to breathe new life into this once popular community local. The pub will have a new name and focus on sports." The pub contractor also provided internal concept photos. A new concept menu has also been created for the refurbished boozer, including a variety of shots and bombs with deals, cocktails, wines, beers and spirits. The pub will be wet only. The new name may be a homage to the original Toll House, which was based on the site before it was known as the Rat's Castle, due to an alleged rodent infestation. A reopening date is yet to be confirmed. Nearby, Grand Colas will be opening at 245 Hatfield Road, offering Indian cuisine, quote-unquote, crafted with love and spice. And there's a picture accompanying the article of the Rat's Castle with lots of scaffolding around it. And it says refurbishment is well underway.
Search for young talent to star in Arena's Aladdin pantomime. Show organisers have launched a search for young talent to star in the next St Albans pantomime. The Alban Arena, working with Evolution Productions, is seeking girls to be part of the juvenile ensemble for their upcoming festive production of Aladdin. The family panto will star EastEnders legend Steve McFadden, Phil Mitchell in the BBC One soap, as the booable baddie, along with the arena panto favourite Bob Golding as Dame Dolly, with more casting to be announced soon. The audition registration process kicks off on June the 29th at 2 p.m. at the Alban Arena. To qualify, you must be between 9 and 15 years old as of the 1st of September 2025 and stand shorter than 5 foot 2 inches. No preparations are needed, as you will learn a routine on the day. The panto, which will run from Friday, December the 5th to Wednesday, December 31st, 2025, requires full commitment for both the rehearsal period ahead of opening night and the entire run. Potential stars are advised to come in comfortable clothes and dance shoes and to bring some water.
Inaugural Spring Festival hailed as a major success. Thousands of people enjoyed a new St. Albans City Centre event, which has been hailed as a major success. St. Albans hosted its first Spring Festival, celebrating food, well-being, community spirit and sustainability on Sunday. Among the many attractions were live music, arts and crafts, street theatre and dozens of stalls selling takeaway food, drink and other produce. There were also opportunities to learn, play and create with fun activities. The event saw St. Peter's Street, Chequer Street and High Street closed to traffic. To ensure accessibility, sighted guides and British Sign Language interpreters were in attendance, while there was also priority seating and wheelchair ramps. St. Albans City and District Council organised the event, which was part funded by the UK Shared Prosperity Fund and sponsored by Code Ninjas, Coat St. Albans and Corker Taxis. Councillor Anthony Rowlands, lead for events, said, "I am delighted at how well our first Spring Festival was received and have no doubt that it was a major success. This was a new city centre event and the response from our residents and visitors was outstanding. There was a huge turnout, with people enjoying the many exciting activities and entertainment that were on offer, much of it free." He added, "One of our aims was to highlight the district's thriving hospitality sector, and it was pleasing to see so many people sampling their food and drink products at the many stalls that were in operation. I would like to thank our events team and our sponsors for making this wonderful event possible, and I am sure we will look to bring it back next year. The crowds show there is certainly a demand for it." And there are photos accompanying the story of people having a wonderful time, children playing in the streets, singers, people riding puppet horses, and even a boy falling off an inflatable bucking bronco, Shaun the Sheep.
An article now about the breadth of hospice care. After a survey showed common misconceptions, Rennie Grove Peace Hospice is raising awareness about the full extent of hospice care. Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care is urging residents to find out what modern hospice care is, after an independent survey commissioned by the charity revealed that 81% of residents surveyed in Hertfordshire hold outdated or inaccurate beliefs about hospice care. Many associate it only with end-of-life services and fail to recognise the wide-ranging support available for patients and their families. The research found that 81% of adults in the county hold at least one common misconception. Among the most persistent myths were the beliefs that hospice care is only for people at the end of life, 33%, that support ends when the patient dies, 27%, or that hospices are hospital-like places, 24%. Rennie Grove Peace, which supports people with progressive, life-limiting illnesses, is now calling for greater awareness around the breadth of hospice care, which includes emotional, practical, and spiritual support, as well as medical care, and is available from point of diagnosis with a life-limiting illness. The charity helps patients to live well during their illness by providing a variety of outpatient, hospice at home, and inpatient care. Services provided by Rennie Grove Peace are available to people with any progressive life-limiting illness, not just cancer. This includes heart disease, respiratory illness, and neurological conditions such as motor neurone disease, as well as many others. The charity's support is available to those around each patient and includes emotional support as well as bereavement services. Lorraine, who was referred to Rennie Grove Peace in 2024, said, "Going into a hospice can be quite scary because the word hospice makes you think of a place where people go to spend their final days. I had no idea there were so many activities to get involved in before that happens." Lorraine has accessed a wide range of services at Grove House, including creative therapy, emotional support, physiotherapy, living well classes, and an advanced care planning course. She added, "It's just a shame people don't know more about all the extra help they can give you, as it's transformed my life." Penny, a 45-year-old mum of two, shared similar reflections after being referred to Rennie Grove Peace shortly after her diagnosis with stage 4 breast cancer. She said, "My initial reaction was, why would I want to go to a hospice? That's where people go to die. But I had it all wrong. Hospices are also there for people like me who have just been diagnosed." Penny has received Reiki, acupuncture, emotional support, and participated in courses that helped her manage fatigue, pain, and the emotional impact of her diagnosis. Sarah Klinger, medical director at Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care, said, "We're here to help people live well for as long as possible, not just in their final days. We're concerned that people are missing out on the care that they need as they have outdated or inaccurate beliefs about what hospice care is. That's why we're educating local people on what hospice care is, to make sure that everybody in our community knows they can turn to us if they are or someone they know is diagnosed with a progressive life-limiting illness. To find out more information about the services offered at Rennie Grove Peace, please visit our website at renniegrovepeace.org/what-is-hospice-care.
Methodist Church set to host history lectures. A new venue is set to host the Harpenden and District Local History Society's summer term lectures. The series of talks will be held at the High Street Methodist Church, which has undergone a recent makeover, replacing the pews with individual seats and installing a state-of-the-art AV system. The program begins with Annie Brewster's talk, My Year as High Sheriff, at 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 27th. On Tuesday, June the 24th, there will be a double bill, including Methodism in Harpenden by Reverend Mark Hammond, followed by Selection of Harpenden Folk by Alison Bork. Finally, on Tuesday, July the 22nd, a lecture entitled Son of Harpenden, Hero in China, George Hogg, 1915-45, will be presented by Hogg's nephew and biographer Mark Thomas on the exact 80th anniversary of Hogg's death. Hogg saved the lives of 60 boys in China during the Second Sino-Japanese War. Roger Butterworth, chairman of the society, said, 210 people attended our previous lecture, which is another record. Building on that success, we have a varied and extended program for the coming months. This also sees a change of location to High Street Methodist Church, Harpenden, following a recent makeover. And there's a picture of the statue of George Hogg at Lanzhou City University in China.
Call to retain care workers. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper, on the government's policies to reduce the number of people who can come to the country to work and how it will affect the care sector. The Prime Minister catapulted immigration back to the top of the political agenda, announcing new policies to reduce the number of people who can come to this country to work. Amongst its many proposals, the government wants to make it harder for British businesses to access skilled worker visas, cut the time that foreign students can stay here after graduating, and stop the recruitment of care workers from abroad. For years, the previous Conservative government failed to invest in skills, leaving struggling businesses no choice but to import workers instead. Now, Labour's decision to restrict immigration before tackling the skills shortage is raising alarm bells and could lead to a collapse in some sectors, with universities, hospitality, construction and the care sector amongst those most at risk. Some have been blunt and say Labour's new policies could decimate the care sector. The Care Association Alliance specifically warned against rushing through changes when so many UK care workers are leaving the profession because of low pay, poor conditions and lack of career progression. We Liberal Democrats have long called for policy changes to help retain workers in the care sector, a higher carers' minimum wage, a Royal College of Care Workers to develop training and status for the profession, and for the government's cross-party talks on social care to be given priority and completed this year, not in 3 years' time. But the government has ignored our calls so far. Labour's new anti-immigrant agenda may not even make sense politically. Overall, polling consistently shows that the British public have a sophisticated view of immigration. Public concern is largely focused on small boats rather than migration for work or study, and new polling out last week found that British people are overwhelmingly against reducing the entry of skilled workers, from doctors, 77%, and care home workers, 71%, to fruit pickers, 70%, catering staff, 63%, lorry drivers, 63%, and engineers, 65%. Two-thirds, 65%, say that they would not reduce the number of students coming to the UK either. The Labour Party's first 10 months in government has been no honeymoon. Cutting winter fuel payments, taxing family farms, and cutting benefits to the disabled have all resulted in Labour dropping in the polls. But trying to win back votes with policies that could further damage our care sector and struggling industries is beyond short-sighted.
Finally, a few words from former High Sheriff of Hertfordshire Annie Brewster, who looks back on her role. I had a simple ambition to raise awareness of this historic and invariably unknown role, to celebrate the outstanding individuals and organisations who are making a difference in our communities, and to inspire future generations to become High Sheriffs. Having previously served as the chairman of Herts County Council, I had a helpful head start in receiving invitations to visit all our towns and villages. I was privileged to attend almost 640 engagements, made possible through my exceptional PA, who masterfully controlled my diary and, when not on a horse, those all-important plum parking spaces. Engagements split almost equally into thirds: our traditional shrieval duties, involving the judiciary, police, citizenship ceremonies, civic events, etc., engagement with the county's vast number of charitable organisations, and my chosen theme, Sport for Good. My theme highlighted remarkable initiatives across Herts that use sport and physical activity as vehicles for social transformation, be it through crime reduction, educational achievement, community cohesion, improved mental health, or tackling social isolation. Again and again, we heard how many struggles, including addiction, so often stem from childhood trauma, and then saw how structured, active pursuits had changed lives. I've loved offering my support to help break down barriers to participation by connecting people, suggesting funding avenues, and amplifying great projects through various High Sheriff social media platforms. The support I've received has been truly wonderful. Oaklands College, one of the UK's leading sports colleges, hosted my garden party, where students shared powerful personal stories of how sport was shaping their lives and futures. With help from the Herts Sports and Physical Activity Partnership, I visited all our 35 park runs, an excellent opportunity to speak directly to thousands of lycra-clad residents about the role of the High Sheriff. We also visited Herts County Council's extensive Health Walks network, together with other community organisations, presenting nearly 100 High Sheriff recognition awards to dedicated volunteers whose tireless work is allowing huge participation. The partnership also supported my High Sheriff Award ceremony at the University of Hertfordshire, where all recognition award recipients were invited and further competing groups received a financial award, with some additional personal awards made for outstanding service. The award ceremony showcased an eclectic mix of projects, from prison-based triathlons and boxing programs building teen resilience, to initiatives distributing pre-loved sports shoes, providing exercise-based cancer rehabilitation, promoting inclusive disability sports, and offering daily activity-led rehabilitation for ex-offenders. One former offender has qualified as an LTA tennis coach, and another has launched a fishing business. The University School of Law also hosted my High Sheriff lecture, where Murray Rosen KC, a renowned barrister and sports arbitrator, delivered a compelling address titled, Is Sport Worth Regulating? His insights left the audience with a new understanding of the role law plays in sport and its broader societal implications. I was heartened to hear from young girls who, upon hearing from a female High Sheriff with a ceremonial sword, decided they would like to take on the role themselves one day. This year has taught me the immense power of recognition. In a time when so many voluntary organisations are calling out for more hands and hearts, a simple thank you has never been more powerful or more necessary and demonstrated how vital our role is. And there is a splendid picture of Annie Brewster on Scotty, a Paralympian horse, and she's wearing a beautiful plumed hat. And it's prior to handing over the Hertfordshire sword to her successor, Nicholas Buxton.
A lesson from Everlasting Lane. Imogen de la Bear, who is a New Zealand writer living in St Albans, on the clean-up of Everlasting Lane in St Albans, and believing in a beneficent God. A prominent politician recently said of a competing political party, "They're the sort of people who are good at fixing the church roof," as if this were an insult. This rather backfired, because it turns out the public really like local politicians who sort out local issues. I thought of this the other day when walking home along Everlasting Lane, a footpath, hundreds of years old, which runs alongside St Albans Hospital, parallel with the Ring Road. It is a route that I used with trepidation, as it was dark and forbidding and full of rubbish. I always expected to meet someone or something scary. But then I remembered the local council had made it a project to clean up and restore the path. The transformation was electrifying. I walked the whole length in absolute delight, not hurrying towards the end, looking about me anxiously as I used to. Birds were bursting with spring fever. The hawthorn trees were in furious bloom. The path was fringed with waves of Queen Anne's lace, and there wasn't a sign of the dumped mattresses and empty drink bottles and more disgusting items of litter. I walked, rejoicing, not just in that we have a practical council that knows what people want, but in the simple beauty of nature that can be found in the least likely places. Our lives are plagued by uncertainty, and for many people, fear. We are suddenly ambushed by illness or misfortune. It is often hard to believe in a beneficent God when surrounded with horror and sadness. But although I share the fear and sadness, I find that something as simple as a walk along Everlasting Lane will restore my hope. My rational brain tells me that a simple walk along a beautiful path in spring is no antidote to the suffering of the world. But happily for us, we are not formed merely of the rational. The spirit can be filled with joy, even in the darkest night. So being a spiritual creature, I thank my Creator that it is so. I thank my Creator for birdsong and hawthorn and thoughtful local councillors.
And in Hearts Cricket League news, Harpenden and Radlett win again. Harpenden and Radlett made it 2 wins from 2 in the Hearts Premier Cricket League Premiership. Harpenden seemed to be in desperate need to watch the FA Cup, and while they missed kick-off, they were showered and changed and in place well before the start of the second half, after a 9-wicket success at Welwyn Garden City. Radlett, meanwhile, had to wait for North Mimms to finish their 50 overs to claim a 33-run success, almost missing Crystal Palace lift the famous trophy. Harpenden's win was hugely impressive, with bowlers and batsmen both in impressive form. Having lost the toss and be put into the field, Harps made their hosts pay by taking 2 wickets inside 8 overs and holding Welwyn to 67 for 4, in the 22nd over. Dylan Desai, 40, Henry Hawkins, 41, and then skipper Alex Chalker, 41, tried their best to keep things interesting, But when Chalker went with Welwyn Garden City on 190 for eight in the 44th over, the end was nigh, and came 1-5 balls later with no further runs scored. Andrew Neil backed up his 3-29 last week with 4-34, and 6 of the 7 bowlers used took wickets. What followed next was a simple dismantling job. James Latham and Scott Galloway put on 107 runs for the first wicket before Latham went for 55 at the end of the 10th over. This had come after facing just 34 deliveries and contained 9 fours and 2 sixes. Galloway ploughed on through and went from 47 in 28 balls to 107 runs in 61, still unbeaten at the end. He bagged 15 fours and 5 maximums, supported by Usman Malik, who got the more modest 19 not out in 15 balls. Radlett, meanwhile, were always in charge, having got to 253 for 8 in their 50 overs. 6 of their top 8 batsmen made double figures, with 4 of them at 30 or over. Top scorer was Neil Mould, who made 63, 2 ahead of Fraser Crawford, with whom he shared 90 runs for the 4th wicket. Viv Paver was the one man in the North Mims lineup who looked like he could be a fly in the ointment, and while the number 3 batsman kept them in touch of the required run rate for the opening 20 overs, he was finding partners hard to come by. He had arrived in the second over and had seen 2 teammates depart in just 16 balls, leaving them on 23-3. Only Zayed Qureshi stuck with him for any length of time, the pair putting on 80 before the newer man departed for 38. Paver persevered though, and would eventually get 101 from 118 balls before he was the 8th man out with Mims. That was on the first ball of the 47th over, with the home side on 197 and 57 runs short. They would be all out in the final over, but the fight had gone from them with Paver's departure. Noah Cornwall, 2-37, and Archie Harrison, 2-45, led the Radlett bowling. And there's a great picture of Fraser Crawford, who got among the runs for Radlett.
The Abbey Church of England Voluntary Aided Primary School celebrates a glowing Ofsted. The staff and team of a St Albans primary school are delighted to achieve a glowing Ofsted rating. The Abbey Church of England Voluntary Aided Primary School received a good report following an ungraded inspection in April 2025. Inspectors said, "Pupils relish attending what's an exceptionally happy school," and suggested that the school has improved significantly across all areas since its last assessment. Head teacher Mrs. Linda O'Melia said, "This wonderful feedback is heartfelt recognition of the passion, hard work and commitment shown every day by our pupils, staff, governors and families. I am incredibly proud of how far we've come and of the nurturing, aspirational culture that we've built together." The inspector's findings of no areas for improvement is a tremendous endorsement of our shared values, our vision, and of the high standards that we strive for. While we are proud of this achievement, we remain firmly focused on continuing to build our success and ensuring the very best for every child. During a 2-day inspection, Ofsted praised the school's high expectation of pupils, allowing them to achieve exceptionally well across the curriculum. The report began, "The school has a strong sense of family. Pupils welcome and support each other, celebrating their similarities and differences. Students also have a plethora of opportunities to develop their leadership skills. Staff were praised for knowing pupils individually to ensure that their needs are met and interests are developed. Ofsted continued, teachers rigorously check pupils' knowledge, including when the pupils join the school. They identify and address pupils' misconceptions and any gaps in the pupils' learning. Staff also have a precise understanding of pupils' needs and interests. Teachers adjust the curriculum with great skill to make it accessible to students with special educational needs and disabilities. Students demonstrated exemplary behaviour during the inspection and showed that they're enthused by their learning. Pupils are determined to be the best they can be, Ofsted added. They are positive and polite and play enthusiastically and cooperatively. Another aspect receiving high praise was the school's variety of extracurricular activities. Ofsted said, pupils are fully prepared for life beyond school. They understand the importance of diversity. The school develops and broadens pupils' interests, such as in sport and music. It has an important role in the local community. The Abbey's leaders and governors were commended too for placing pupils at the heart of every decision that they make.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, May 24th. And Dinner with Dylan is a drama about three grown men, Boboholics, who meet in a restaurant to chat about the meaning of life and Bob Dylan. Radio 4 at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. The Turn of the Screw, Henry James's chilling 1898 tale, is dramatised on Radio 4 Extra at 4. While Archive on 4 examines the Braveheart effect, looking at how that film contributed to the shaping of modern Scottish identity. The Braveheart effect, Radio 4, Saturday night, 8 o'clock. Sunday, May 25th, Castaway in Desert Island Discs is Nobel Literature Laureate Abdelzarak Gurnah on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While in a revisited 2021 edition of the programme, former goalkeeper Peter Schmeichel is the castaway on Radio 4 Extra at 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. The comedy panel game The Unbelievable Truth, chaired by David Mitchell, is on Radio 4 at 12:30 on Sunday lunchtime. Derek Jacobi reads from the correspondence of actor John Gielgud in Gielgud's Letters, Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 or 6:30 on Sunday afternoon. Next season is a two-part drama in which a young actor gets his first big break, with a repertory theatre company working alongside famous actors and an inventive new director. Part 1 of next season, Radio 4, 3 o'clock, Sunday afternoon. The Round Britain quiz continues on Radio 4 at 4:30, while From Our Own Correspondent is on at 9:30 p.m, Radio 4. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday. Same time, same radio station each day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The rise and fall of the antique charts, the fortunes of antiques, on Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 in the morning, Monday to Friday. Book of the Week is Holding the Line, Barbara Kingsolver's non-fiction book about Arizona women involved in a mining strike in 1983 who took to the picket lines when the union banned its male members from taking part. Radio 4 all week, 11:45 a.m. The Miller's Dance is a reading of the ninth novel in Winston Graham's Poldark series. The 10-part series begins on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 in the morning, 1:30 in the afternoon or 7:30 p.m. every day this week. The Smuggler is also a new 10-part series exploring how Nick, a former soldier in the British Army, became a people smuggler. Radio 4 at 1:45 all week. Composer of the Week, Ludwig van Beethoven, Radio 3, 4 p.m, Monday to Friday. Earthworks is archaeologist Rose Ferriby's second series exploring traces of human history around the British Isles. Radio 3 for this, every night, 9:45 p.m. And Shakedown in Hyperspace, Naomi Wood's series of five feminist sci-fi short stories read by Juliana Jennings. Every day this week, Radio 4, 10:45 p.m. On to the rest of the individual programmes then for the rest of the week, starting with Monday, Bank Holiday Monday, May 26th. The Angel of Islington is a radio drama about an art historian who awakes one morning to find a lost angel sitting at the end of his bed. Radio 4 Extra, 6am, 11am or 5pm. Also on Monday, Great Lives, Emily Williamson, 1855 to 1936, co-founder of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. Radio 4, 3pm. The culinary panel show The Kitchen Cabinet celebrates treacle and bilberries on Radio 4 at 4.30 on Monday afternoon. On the Shipping Postcards, the first of a five-part series in which the members of the Radio 4 continuity team, the voices of the shipping forecast, travel to some of its celebrated areas, Lundy, Dogger, Forth, Irish Sea and White. Radio 4, 9.45, Monday night. Tuesday, May 27th, and Wired Love looks at how the invention of the telegraph led to social changes in the role of women. Radio 4 Extra, 10.30 in the morning or 4.30 in the afternoon. Lucy Worsley continues her series about lady swindlers with a look at the life of Catherine Murphy, a single mother of three who had a small business making counterfeit coins in 1780s London, at a time when counterfeiting money was treated by law as treason and the penalty for women was death by burning at the stake. Radio 4, Tuesday afternoon, 3 o'clock. Peter White presents his regular programme In Touch with news and features for the blind and partially sighted on Radio 4 at 8.40pm. Well, afterwards, in the Law Show, in the wake of the hacking of IT systems at Marks and Spencer's and the Co-op, the programme asks whether you can sue if your private data is stolen. Radio 4 again for this, 9pm on Tuesday. While for jazz fans, alternatively, Jamie Cullum's Jazz Show is on Radio 2 at 9. Wednesday, May 28th, and from the series The Rivals, comes the dramatisation of M. MacDonald Bodkin's 1914 tale, A Snapshot. Radio 4 Extra at 6 in the morning, 11am or 5pm. Choral Evensong on Wednesday comes from St. David's Cathedral for the Eve of the Ascension. Radio 3, 3pm. In Just One Thing with Michael Mosley, the late presenter finds out how gardening can boost the gut, benefiting health and wellness. Radio 4, 8.45pm. And The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is on Radio 2 on Wednesday at 9pm. Thursday, May 29th, in Great Lives, Michael Palin discusses the legacy of writer Ernest Hemingway. Radio 4 Extra, 10 in the morning or 4 in the afternoon. In a new series of Toast, the programme that tells stories of business failures, the subject is the rise and falls of Woolies, Woolworths. How did the high street favourite go from having more than 1,000 high street stores to zero? Radio 4, 12.30 on Thursday. In Ramblings, Claire Balding marks her 25 years of presenting the programme by walking her second stretch of the world-famous pilgrimage route, the Camino de Santiago, joined by the Reverend Maggie McLean, a canon at York Minster. Radio 4, 3 o'clock, Thursday afternoon. BBC Inside Science is on Radio 4 at 4.30. And the Today podcast with Amarajan and Nick Robinson with the biggest news stories of the week, Radio 4, 11pm. Finally, Friday, May 30th, and the end of another month, the series Soul Music explores the enduring appeal of Procol Harum's Summer of 67 classic, A Whiter Shade of Pale. Radio 4 Extra at 10 in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The first in a new series of Rare Earth asks the question, are insects the answer? Insects are in trouble. Their numbers are plummeting, with reports of huge die-offs and scientists warning that people ignore this at their peril. Radio 4, just after midday on Friday. The topical panel game, the news quiz, is on Radio 4 at 6.30pm. The political forum, any questions, on Radio 4 at 8. While Americast offers insight and analysis on what is happening inside Trump's White House. Radio 4, 11pm. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
Now for the audio described television programmes for Saturday 24th of May to Friday 30th of May, compiled by Lisa and read by Chris. On Saturday 24th, BBC One has The Great Food Guys at 11:30 a.m, whilst ITV One offers a brand new cookery show at 11:40, Jeremy Pang's Hong Kong Kitchen. If gardens are more your thing, visit South Africa's Kirsten Bosch Gardens in Around the World in 80 Gardens on BBC Two at 9. Stay with BBC Two to catch Alan Carr at 11 in the penultimate episode of Interior Design Masters, which this week comes from Edinburgh. There's afternoon fun on BBC One with Wallace and Gromit, A Close Shave, at 3 p.m, in which Wallace falls in love and Gromit is framed for sheep rustling. This is followed by the feature-length Vengeance Most Foul at 3:45. More Wallace and Gromit comedy with the voice of Ben Whitehead. Saturday evening entertainment starts with The Piano at 5 p.m. on Channel 4, with the final concert only weeks away. BBC One has Doctor Who at 6:50, in which old enemies unite as the Doctor and Belinda finally arrive home. Then in Casualty at 8:10, Ryder has a traumatic day and Indy helps Ian on a special mission. At 9, there's the first episode of a brand new 6-part mystery drama, The Anniversary, based on Leanne Moriarty's best-selling novel. An intriguing-sounding documentary airs on BBC Two at 9. Liza, a truly terrific, absolutely true story, focuses on the life and career of actor and singer Liza Minnelli. Channel 4 provides movie action with Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1 at 8 p.m, starring Tom Cruise as IMF agent Ethan Hunt, followed by The Running Man at 11:10, a sci-fi action thriller based on the novel by Stephen King. Now for Sunday's options. The daytime schedule is a little thin, but you can catch up with Homes Under the Hammer at 11 on BBC One, who are also showing Toy Story 4 at 2:30, a comedy adventure featuring the voices of Tom Hanks and Tim Allen. Much more variety on offer this evening. A new series of the very popular Walking with Dinosaurs starts at 6:25 on BBC One. Then at 8:15, there's another new series, Death Valley. The title may be misleading, as it's a crime comedy drama set in Wales and starring Timothy Spall. BBC Two has Scandinavia with Simon Reeve at 9 p.m, when the second leg of Simon's journey takes him from the fjords of Norway to volcanic Iceland. Over on ITV One, the crime thriller Code of Silence continues at 9. Rose Ailing Ellis stars. Excitement for music lovers on Channel 4 with the final of The Piano at 9. 7 amateur pianists must battle backstreet nerves before performing in front of the sold-out theatre in Gateshead. Channel 4 also has a late-night film offering at 10:55, 3,000 Years of Longing, a romantic fantasy set in Istanbul. During the week, the regular soap operas are on at the following times. On Monday, it's EastEnders at 7:30 on BBC One, Emmerdale at 7:30 on ITV One, and Corrie at 8 on ITV One. Tuesday has EastEnders at 7:30 and Emmerdale at 7:30. On Wednesday, it's EastEnders at 7:30 and Emmerdale at 7:30 with Corrie at 8. and on Thursday is EastEnders at 7:30 and Emmerdale on 7:30. Moving on to Monday the 26th of May, which is also a bank holiday. They're coming thick and fast at this time of the year. BBC Two takes you to the Galapagos Islands at 3:45 with Islands of Change, a natural world film examining how the archipelago's creatures are adapting to changing circumstances. Then at 7 p.m, there's more extraordinary wildlife in a new series, Amazon, Earth's Great Rivers. Still on BBC Two, at 9, there's a real treat this evening for Austinites. Jane Austen, Rise of a Genius. The story of how a self-taught woman from a small country village became one of the greatest and best-loved figures in English literature. This is followed at 10 by a screening of the 2005 film version of Pride and Prejudice, starring Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadyen. For some light-hearted bank holiday silliness, ITV1 has The Chase Celebrity Special at 6:30 p.m, then gets more serious at 9 with Episode 4 of Code of Silence. Over on Channel 4, there's Jamie Oliver Cook's Georgia, a one-off special combining food and travel, as Jamie explores the fascinating cuisine and wine of Georgia, from the markets of Tbilisi to the vineyards of Kinkali. And now it's Tuesday. Catch up with Bargain Hunt at 12:15 p.m. on BBC One, with the two teams searching for antiques in West Sussex. Staying with BBC One, at 2:45 in Escape to the Country, Nikki Chapman helps a first-time buyer find a home in Shropshire. BBC One's evening highlights include Sort Your Life Out with Stacey Solomon at 8 p.m, followed by Who Do You Think You Are at 9 p.m. Presenter Fred Siriex returns to France to explore his roots and is intrigued by a family love story. BBC Two has Nigella's Cook, Eat, Repeat at 7:30 p.m, in which Nigella bakes a cake layered with chocolate and peanut butter, and also creates a Basque cheesecake with a licorice sauce. Not sure about licorice with cheesecake. Also, on a baking theme, over on Channel 4 at 8, there's a new series of Bake Off the Professionals. The search for the best patisserie team in Britain returns. ITV1 has the perennially popular Alan Titchmarsh in Love Your Garden at 8. Back to BBC Two at 9 for Implosion, the Titanic sub-disaster. This documentary investigates the events of June 2023 when the Titan submersible went missing during a dive to the wreck of the Titanic. It's Wednesday, and light-hearted lunchtime entertainment is available in the form of Bargain Hunt on BBC One at 12:15, when Christina Trevanian hosts in Newark and visits the Welbeck estate. BBC One has the repair shop On the Road at 8, when the experts restore items in Ayrshire on Scotland's west coast. Items as varied as a folding three-piece canoe and a handwritten book of Gaelic pipe music. This is followed by Episode 6 of Race Across the World at 9 p.m. With more than two-thirds of the race completed, the teams leave the Himalayas and head to Gujarat. An interesting documentary on BBC Two at 9, The Rise and Fall of Michelle Moon, the story of how Michelle Moon rose from Glasgow's East End to become a millionaire entrepreneur. Success was to come at a high price. More light-hearted fare over on ITV1 at 9 with Genius Game. The remaining contestants take part in their first team game as they play Diamond Dilemma. David Tennant hosts. Channel 4 have a strong property theme this evening, with Location, Location, Location at 8. Kirsty and Phil are aiding and abetting house hunters in and around Oxford. This is followed at 9 by Britain's Most Expensive Houses. In case anyone has £21 million to spare for a beachside mansion. Round off the evening with Gogglebox at 10, when the armchair critics share their opinions on what they have been watching during the week. Now for Thursday. A big night for fans of design and or Alan Carr, with the grand final of Interior Design Masters on BBC One at 8. The two finalists head to Portmeirion in Wales to redesign two quirky cottages. But which one will succeed and secure a major contract to create a range with a national retailer? There's lavish costume drama over on BBC Two at 9 with episode 4 of Marie Antoinette, followed by Detectorists at 10, in which Andy and Lance start unearthing some worthwhile pieces in this lovely gentle comedy. Channel 4 has the first of a two-part documentary at 8, Britain Under the Nazis, The Forgotten Occupation. In June 1940, the Channel Islands were invaded by Hitler's forces. Contributors help paint a picture of a world of informants, forced labour camps and brave resistance. In total contrast, this is followed by Taxmaster at 9. There's a late night movie option on ITV1 with The Taking of Pelham 123 at 10:45 p.m. Starring Denzel Washington and John Travolta, this is a remake of the 1974 thriller in which an armed gang holds passengers of a New York subway train hostage. And so to Friday. A rare find on BBC One at 2 p.m, a new daytime drama series, Under the Vines. A former Australian socialite and a London lawyer inherit a failing vineyard in New Zealand. Then at 4 p.m, Garden Rescue has the team transforming a Bristol garden into a Mediterranean wildlife haven. Evening offerings on BBC One include Alison Hammond's Big Weekend at 8:30 and a new series of The Power of Parker at 9, the return of the comedy about Stockport businessman Martin Parker. Over on BBC Two at 9, there's episode 3 of Hidden Treasure of the National Trust. Channel 4 has Millionaire Hoarders at 8 and some late night comedy at 11:05. Fans of John Lycett have the chance to see him return to his first love, stand-up, performing at the Apollo in West London. If you prefer a classic late-night movie, ITV1 is showing From Russia with Love at 10:45. Sean Connery stars as James Bond, 007. And that concludes this week's ADTV listings. Hopefully there is something of interest here for everyone.
DNF Soundings.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Keith, and here he is.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to 10 Today. This is broadcast number 9. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. We want you to do all this exercise safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you are feeling throughout the session. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, please stop and seek medical advice. Please remember, you agree to take part at your own risk. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, it would be ideal if you could use a hard chair that you can sit upright in, and preferably one without arms that can get in the way of some exercises. Now, with your feet flat on the floor. Okay, if you are stood up, just step your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders and stand up nice and tall, and take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor, keep your back straight, relax your shoulders, and take a couple of deep breaths. In and out, in and out. So, the first exercise is called Reach for the Stars. So raise both your arms up to the sky, or stars. When at the top, raise on your toes, and then lower down both your feet and arms, pushing down with your palms down. So keep going, raising your hands up, then up on your toes. Then lower down your hands and feet, and keep going, feeling that nice stretch through the upper body and shoulders. So, just a couple more now. Next, Strike of the Cobra. A wee bit of martial arts. So, with a strong stance, with your fists clenched in front of your chest, like you are a boxer, punch your right hand straight out and return. Then, with the same hand, punch it to the left side so your arm crosses your body and reaches towards the ceiling. So you're punching up and across and return. Now, with your left hand, punch straight out and return. Then punch to the right side so your arm crosses your body, reaching for that ceiling again. Try not to worry with the logistics on this one. Just energetic punching is good. Keep going now with alternate hands at your own pace. So punching straight and then to the side, pointing up to the ceiling. This is great for strengthening those arms. You should all be feeling nice and warm now. Now we have the side stretch. Raise your right arm high, straight up with your palm facing up, then lean over to your left side, feeling that stretch all along your right side. Now returning back to the centre. Raise your left hand straight up and feel that stretch all the way down your left side. Now, keep alternating, feeling that nice stretch down your side. So arm up and lean over and repeat. Great work. Well done. Next up is Swing Back. If you're standing, keep your legs straight. If you're sitting, keep your feet flat on the floor. Bend your arms so both hands are at chest height. Then straighten out your right arm and swing it back so you feel a nice rotation in your back, looking towards your right hand. Then return to the center and straighten out your left arm and swing it back, looking towards your left hand, and repeat. So we are just moving side to side, swinging your arms back nice and gently, feeling your back rotate as you move side to side. Just a couple more now. This is a great one for trunk rotation. Next, if you're standing up, you might want to be near something so you can hold on to for balance. This one is a leg raise. If you're standing, lift your leg up to hip height, keeping your knee bent, and return. And if you're sitting, lift your legs slightly higher than hip height and return. Now do the same with the other leg. Lift up to hip height and return. Now, keep going on alternate legs, just lifting those legs up. Next is slowly does it. These exercises are slightly different if you are sitting or standing. So if you're standing, bend at your knees slightly to halfway and hold. And then bend your knees all the way down to your lowest point and hold. And then straighten up your legs again. So we're just moving halfway, holding, moving down to your lowest point, holding, and then coming back up. Keep your feet facing forward and try not to let your knees move in front of your toes. Keep going. If you are sitting, just straighten out your right leg right in front of you and hold briefly, feeling that nice stretch down your leg. Then return your foot to the floor and repeat on the other side. Whichever variation you're doing, you're working your legs. If you're standing, you're also working your bottom. Okay, so keep going, always remembering to keep your back straight. So for those standing, bending knees halfway, hold and then all the way down and then up. And sitting, raising alternate legs. Slow and controlled is more challenging and rewarding. Just a few more. Great work. Push up to the moon. So remember to keep a nice soft bend in your knees and a strong stance. Then bend your arms so both hands are at chest height. Then push both your hands up to the ceiling on your right, like you are pushing up to the moon. And sweep your hands back down and to the left, pushing both your hands up to the ceiling again on your left. And now keep going. So you're just making a nice big U with your hands, pushing up to the moon on either side. When you sweep your hands at the bottom of the U, you can bend over slightly to make that sweeping movement bigger. Keep going with that nice dynamic shape, pushing up to the moon on each side. So again, if you're standing, you might want to be near something for balance. This exercise is called kick across, and you are just kicking your leg across to the opposite side. So kick your right leg to the left side and return. Do the same on the other side. So now keep going, kicking that leg across from side to side. You should feel that working your legs. And slow and controlled is more challenging here. Keep going for a couple more. Good work. Next up is full circle. Raise both arms straight above your head and then sweep them round together to the right, making one big circle all the way back up to the top. And keep going, swinging one big circle to the right. Just a couple more in this direction. Good work. Now we are going to do exactly the same, but the opposite direction. So keep making those nice big circles. It's a great workout for your shoulders, this one. Just a few more now. One more. Great job. Now we really should all be feeling warm. If you're a little out of breath, that's a good thing. It means you've been working. If you're not a little out of breath, can you work a little harder next time? Anyway, nearly finished. We'll just finish off with a nice stretch and a cool down. So we're going to start with a hamstring stretch. So step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean forward gently. Whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of your leg. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Well done. Then return to a stood-up position and swap your legs. So this time step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your right leg and just lean forward gently. Again, feeling that nice long stretch. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Well done. And the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just like you were hugging a tree, directly in front of you. And your arms, they form a nice circle in front of you. And then cup your hands, putting one hand in front of the other, and push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across your shoulders and arms. Hold 4, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now sit up or stand up and return to that nice relaxed posture we had at the beginning. Brilliant. So that was all the exercises. We hope you enjoyed them. Just to finish off, shake it out. So just shake those arms and hands and then legs and feet. Great work, everyone. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have a great health benefits. It's fun and you'll simply feel better. So do keep going. Thank you very much for listening. This is Keith.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, I'm David, and here are some historical events that took place this week in the past. On May the 25th in 1720, on this date, the ship Le Grand Saint-Antoine arrived in Marseille, bringing Europe's last major plague outbreak. Also known as the Plague of Provence, this was the last major outbreak of bubonic plague in Western Europe. The disease killed over 100,000 people, 50,000 in the city during the next 2 years, and another 50,000 to the north in surrounding provinces and towns. While economic activity took only a few years to recover as trade expanded to the West Indies and Latin America, it was not until 1765 that the population returned to its pre-1720 level. And on May the 26th, 1805, Napoleon Bonaparte was crowned King of Italy in Milan Cathedral. He was crowned with the Iron Crown of Lombardy by the Cardinal Archbishop of Milan. The event was a symbolic move, indicating Napoleon's control over the newly formed Kingdom of Italy, which was a vassal state of the French Empire. The act solidified Napoleon's control over northern Italy, which he had previously organised into the Cisalpine Republic, and later the Italian Republic. The Kingdom of Italy was a new entity, with Napoleon as its head, further expanding his influence beyond France. And then on the 27th of May in 1937, that was the date that the Golden Gate Bridge officially opened to the public. The Golden Gate Bridge, designed by Joseph Strauss and Irving Morrow, is a suspension bridge spanning the Golden Gate, the one-mile-wide strait connecting San Francisco Bay and the Pacific Ocean in California, United States. On the opening day, an estimated 200,000 people walked, ran, or roller skated across the bridge in celebration. The bridge officially opened to vehicular traffic the following day on May the 28th, when the then President Roosevelt pressed a button in Washington, D.C. The bridge, a monumental engineering feat, remains a symbol of the city to this day. On the 28th of May in 585 BC, a solar eclipse in Asia Minor brought an abrupt halt to a battle as the warring armies laid down their arms and declared a truce. Historical astronomy later sets a likely date, providing a debatable calculation point for pinning down some dates in ancient history. This was not the first recorded solar eclipse, but the 585 BC eclipse was the first we know that was predicted. The Greek historian Herodotus wrote that Talus of Milete predicted an eclipse in a year when the Medians and the Lydians were at war. We do not know the method Talus used in making his prediction. However, he made the prediction, and however precise or vague it may have been, the eclipse did occur. Eilates, the king of Lydia, was battling Cyaxares, the king of the Medes, probably near the river Halys, in what is now central Turkey. The heavens darkened. Soldiers of both kings put down their weapons. The battle was over, and so was the war. And at 11:30 a.m. on May the 29th, 1953, Edmund Hillary of New Zealand and Tenzing Norgay, a Sherpa of Nepal, became the first known explorers to reach the summit of Mount Everest, which at 29,035 feet above sea level is the highest point on Earth. The two, part of a British expedition, made their final assault on the summit after spending a fitful night at 27,900 feet. News of their achievement broke around the world on June the 2nd, the day of Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, and Britons hailed it as a good omen for their country's future. Mount Everest sits on the crest of the Great Himalayas in Asia, lying on the border between Nepal and Tibet. Called Chomo Lungma, or Mother Goddess of the Land by the Tibetans, the English named the mountain after Sir George Everest, a 19th century British surveyor of South Asia. The summit of Mount Everest reaches two-thirds of the way through the air of the Earth's atmosphere, at about the cruising altitude of jet airliners, and oxygen levels there are very low, temperatures are extremely cold, and the weather is unpredictable and dangerous. The first recorded attempt to climb Everest was made in 1921 by a British expedition that trekked 400 difficult miles across the Tibetan plateau to the foot of the Great Mountain. A raging storm forced them to abort their ascent, but the mountaineers, among them George Lee Mallory, had seen what appeared to be a feasible route up the peak. It was Mallory who quipped, when later asked by a journalist why he wanted to climb Everest, "Because it's there." On May the 30th, in 1431, that was the date on which Joan of Arc was burned at the stake in Rouen, in France, after being accused of heresy. Joan of Arc is a patron saint of France, honoured as a defender of the French nation for her role in the Siege of Orléans and her insistence on the coronation of Charles VII of France during the 100 Years' War. Claiming to be acting under divine guidance, she became a military leader who transcended gender roles and gained recognition as a saviour of France. And on May the 31st, 1669, Samuel Pepys, a prominent figure in 17th century England, known for his detailed diary, wrote his final entry. This marked the end of his extensive and historically valuable record of life in London and England during a tumultuous period. Pepys had been experiencing declining eyesight, possibly due to the strain of writing and reading in dim light for extended periods. He expressed concerns about having others write for him, fearing the loss of the intimate, personal nature of his diary. He decided to have a staff member keep the journal in longhand, while he would add notes in shorthand. His final words in the diary were, "And thus ends all that I doubt I shall ever be able to do with my own eyes in the keeping of my journal, I being not able to do it any longer." A poignant record indeed.
Hello, I'm Sue, and here are some famous people's birthdays for this week. The Russian-American Igor Sikorsky, born in Kiev on the 25th of May, 1889. The Russian-American Igor Sikorsky, born in Kiev on the 25th of May, 1889, was a pioneer in both fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters. In 1919, he emigrated to the United States and founded his own aviation company, the Sikorsky Aero Engine Corporation. His company built flying boats for Pan American, and his R-4 helicopter, developed from his experimental VS-300 machine of 1939, became the world's first production helicopter. 26th of May is the birthday of actress Helena Bonham Carter, great-granddaughter of Liberal Prime Minister Lord Asquith. Her paternal grandmother was the politician and feminist Violet Bonham Carter. She is renowned for her versatility and has appeared on stage and in television and film dramas. Her roles in the films Lady Jane and A Room with a View brought her to prominence in the mid-1980s. She played the evil witch Bellarix Lestrange in the Harry Potter films and Princess Margaret in 2 seasons of The Crown. The American marine biologist, conservationist and writer Rachel Carson was born on the 27th of May, 1907. She was well known for her writings on environmental pollution and held teaching posts at a number of American universities. She alerted the world to the dangers of fertilizer and pesticides to birds and animals, particularly in her influential book of 1962, Silent Spring. A subsequent government inquiry into the use of pesticides led to the restriction of the use of DDT, although a global ban was not signed until 2001. On the 28th of May, 1660, King George I was born. From 1698 to 1727, he became the Elector of Hanover, and in 1714, following the death of Queen Anne, he became the first Hanoverian King of Great Britain. The Act of Settlement of 1701 dictated that only Protestants could inherit the crown. George I spent large amounts of his time looking after his interests in Germany, but is perhaps best remembered for his commissioning Handel to write the water music for a celebration on the River Thames. 29th of May 1917 is the birthday of John F. Kennedy, the 35th US President. He grew up in a competitive home environment, steeped in Catholicism and an allegiance to the Democratic Party. After his inauguration in 1961, Kennedy signed the first nuclear weapons treaty and advocated for civil rights legislation. He also established the Peace Corps, which sent groups of volunteers to developing countries to assist in the struggle against poverty, illiteracy, and disease. On the 30th of May, 1963, the British chemist and astronaut Helen Sharman was born in Sheffield. In 1991, she made history by becoming the first Briton to travel into space, having been selected for training out of nearly 13,000 applicants. She spent 8 days on a Soviet-British mission known as Project Juno, during which she lived and worked at the Mir space station. Her autobiography is entitled Seize the Moment. Currently she works part-time at Imperial College London. The pianist and composer Billy Mayall was born in London on the 31st of May, 1902. From an early age, he studied at Trinity College of Music and performed the Grieg Piano Concerto at the age of 9. In 1925, he gave the first British Isles performance of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. After playing for silent films and in the Savoy Havana Band, he opened his own School of Syncopation and is widely recognised for some of his 300-plus novelty piano solos, particularly Marigola from 1927.
Thank you, Sue. And now the piece Billy Mayall is best known for, Marigold, played by Richard Rodney Bennett.
Thank you. Hello, it's Clive Davis from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. Some of the recordings that you hear are from our annual competitions. This one is by Simon Elliott and is titled The North Pennines. Simon explains the various bird songs throughout the recording. Please enjoy.
I'm sitting by the grave of an adulterer and a vagabond. Well, that's according to one legend. It's more likely that the tall wooden cross against which I'm leaning marks the junction of two ancient drove roads, which once would have echoed to the sound of cattle and sheep being herded south across the border. Today you can hear a very different soundscape in one of the quietest places in England. I'm in the North Pennines, 400 metres above sea level, on a perfect April morning, under a gin-clear sky. To the north I can see Hadrian's Wall, beyond that the Cheviot Hills, and I'm looking across what most people would think of as empty wilderness. But this landscape is really as much man-made as the Roman Wall or the nearby city of Newcastle, which I can see just 25 miles away as the raven flies. These uplands have been managed for hundreds, probably thousands of years. The names we still use for the fell and the moor originate in Old Norse, and without these chaps... this would probably still be woodland. As it is, these hills are remarkable in that they hold healthy populations of bird species which have disappeared from most of England, and overhead the skylark song is probably the most familiar. Every morning I'll see a few black grouse, and their bubbling displays are a constant backdrop to a spring dawn. But it's the other one, the red grouse, which is as influential as our ovine friends are on this landscape. Grouse shooting is a multi-million pound business. That's why the heathermoors are still here. They are understandably wary birds, but with careful observation and planning, I could get my mics next to this pair of males at one of their grit stations to record their close conversation. Before grouse shooting, there was another industry up here, when widespread lead mining made this a very unhealthy place to be. But the miners and their families came here and cultivated the land, pushing the heather line up to its highest level in Britain, and creating what is now a rich habitat of damp, brushy ground and moorland, attracting thousands of wading birds, breeding at a higher density here than anywhere else in England. Before the spring dawn, the air throbs with drumming snipe or their chippering calls from the ground. And early morning is also the best time to hear displaying lapwing. Indeed, up here, this habitat is known as Peasweepland. We still have redshank breeding up here, albeit in somewhat reduced numbers, and with their constant vigilance and piercing calls, they live up to their name of Wardens of the Marsh. The wistful voice of Golden Plover is my own favourite. Their single alarm note is well known to hill walkers. Then, on clear days, they transform from a furious, fast-flying wader to a magical spirit of the sky, circling high above, wings hardly moving, uttering a call which always makes my spine tingle. But there is one wader that epitomises these magnificent hills, one which loudly declares its English name. The UK holds almost one-third of the world population of curlew, but there has been a catastrophic decline of breeding pairs, of over 50% since 1995. However, in the North Pennines, they are doing so well that on a spring morning, I cannot count the sheer number of birds as they glide in display over the fell. Why they are doing so well here is a matter of considerable research, but early indications point, once again, to the influence of man in this ancient landscape. Ironically, it appears that the waders, as well as the blackcock, are benefiting not only from the habitat, but also from the high level of keepering for red grouse management. You don't come up here to see foxes, or stoats, or carrion crows. This area of outstanding natural beauty is, in reality, far from natural. It has long been, and it still is, sculpted by the hand of man. But with luck for years to come, I'll still be able to sit here and be thrilled by this iconic sound.
That was a recording by Simon Elliott of the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. I'm now handing you over to Rob, who spent a most interesting afternoon recently talking with listener Olga Hopkins.
My guest, and I'm very pleased to meet her and to be able to interview her, is Mrs. Olga Hopkins, who very recently visited Buckingham Palace for a reason that we're going to discover a bit later. But before we get there, can we go back to the beginning? Because you lived in interesting times. You were born in the 20s.
I was. Yes, I was born in Monmouthshire. My father was a miner, and having served all the way through the First World War, he came back and there was nothing else to do in South Wales. He had no other qualifications, and so he became a miner. They were very, very poor indeed. I remember it still vividly. By the 1930s, things had got a little better, but not much. I can really tell you with some pride that in 1937, my father must have been one of the very few Conservatives in South Wales, and he was asked to try and form a Conservative Miners' Union. Very foolishly, he accepted the challenge. Of course, he lost. And while the campaign was on, my mother and I were sent away for our own safety. So, you know, that was exciting. I remember 1939 and the growing anxiety and the inevitability that there was going to be war. And I do remember that awful morning at 11 o'clock when Mr. Chamberlain said that we are at war with Germany. My father said, "About bloody time," and my mother cried. And I was very bewildered. By then, we had moved further south to the lovely Vale of Glamorgan, and I was at school at a very small but very good girls' grammar school, Cowbridge High School then, is now an enormous comprehensive. My O-level, whatever we called it then, was really quite good. And so I went to a different school, a mixed school, Tonerevel Grammar School, and there was doing my higher school certificate. At the same time, I was a member of the Women's Junior Air Corps a girl's equivalent of the ATC. And it was very good, and I enjoyed it immensely. I could tell you the aeroplanes of the British Air Force and also the German ones. We distinguished by, we said, by sound, but we thought we knew what they looked like. I also did Morse code and some wonderful marching, at which the girls were very good. By Christmas of 1943, I was feeling a bit fed up with things, and I went into Cardiff and joined the WAF, just like that. And then I went home and told my father, who seemed rather proud. My mother cried again. I don't want to give a picture that she was a weak lady. She wasn't, I can assure you. She was lovely. So in January 1944, my father took me to Cardiff Station, 7:30 in the morning, to become a WAF.
And where did you go to from Cardiff?
In Turnhill, in Shropshire, where we did square bushing, which again I loved. And we had things like medicals. Now, that was very difficult for me, having gone to a girls' school where there weren't any showers, so we didn't have them, where nudity was a very, very private thing indeed. But when you're living communally, it's a different world. And we had to have what they called FFIs, which are free from infection. So half-stripped and look to see if you had any impetigo and things like that, and nits in your hair and so on, and a general examination in a room with several other people. And I found that difficult. And then later on, this was all in one day. Later on, we had three injections, for one for cholera, one for tetanus, and one for malaria, I think. The next day, we had aptitude and intelligence tests. I think the Air Force used the Raven's test. And after a while, this was marked, and somebody said, "You stand over there," to somebody else, "You stand over there." Anyway, I went in that corner, and I was more or less alone for most of it. And then they said, "Oh, you're going to be a wireless mechanic." Well, I think I laughed, really, which was usually my response to surprising things. A wireless mechanic entailed going to Glasgow Royal Technical School and the university for 6 months, followed by an intensive further 4 months in RAF Cranwell. In 1944, in June, we were in Glasgow and we were having our coffee break. And suddenly a man came in waving a newspaper and he said, "D-Day, D-Day has landed." And we cheered like mad. It was only far later in the day that we had some inkling of how awful that delay landing must have been and the number of casualties. After that, I went to a small station called Church Lawford, and then soon went to Wellesbourne Mountford, where we had rather old bombers, Ansons and Blenheims. What I had to do, or we had to do rather, was a daily inspection, having got up at 6:30 and a mass breakfast and things. We then had to go out to the flight, and you'd been given a list of the numbers or the letters of planes. And so you got in the bomber and then you tuned them. If they were working properly, that was fine. And then you called up the watchtower and said, "How do you read me?" You'd say, "Was it 1 to 5? And if they said fine, that was fine. If they said anything else, there was work to be done in the plane. So we either retuned, if we could, and caught the tower again, and that would probably be all right because they were usually pretty minor faults. And then you'd test all the wiring in the plane and all the outlets, the press-to-talk buttons. If anything didn't work, you either mended the buttons and things like that in situ, and you just carried the set back to the section. And then if there was any fault to be discovered, we would do that in the afternoon and then replace it so that it would be serviceable the next day. And then on my 21st birthday, I was moved to RAF Spitalgate. So on my important birthday then, I didn't have a card and I didn't have a present, but I was moved. My parents hadn't heard about moving and had to tell them afterwards. We were a small group moved together and we were pretty fed up, I can tell you. But we went to a party that night when we got to Spitalgate in Lincolnshire. There was a dance. There's always a dance in the Air Force. And we had a lovely big band and dancing. And I was a bit down in the dumps. But we had a flight of Dutch Air Force cadets come over from Amsterdam. And they were about to get their wings, I think, on our station at Spitalgate. So I told one of them, well, I'm really miserable and so on. And so he told the whole lot. And then I had a whale of a time, and the party was memorable, shall we say. This station was the final kind of training for pilots, and we had a very fine aeroplane, a Harvard American plane, and then we had some Spitfires, and that, of course, was the dream of anybody to have to go in here. But I suppose I must have done to have tested the wiring in the nose. It was so beautiful that it was a privilege just to be there, really, to see both planes, which were very, very fine. Soon we came to the 7th of May because we were lying in bed. Perhaps we knew that something, you know, the war was coming to a critical time, and we were on our bed and listening to the American Forces Network, the glamorous WAF pyjamas in blue and white flannel and so on. And suddenly on the tannoy, there came an announcement. The war is over. The war is over. It's going to be signed tomorrow. The war's over. And we all jumped up and we were sort of screaming and wasn't it wonderful? And then somebody said, oh, it's a party at the sergeant's mess. So off we went, put our battle dress over our pyjamas and went up to the sergeant's mess and had a lovely party. I remember the band again and we danced. I think I sang something, Don't Fence Me In. And then on the next day, we all went back to the section. We were flying again, and then in the afternoon we did stop and listen to Churchill. So that was VE Day for me in 1945.
And that's why it's so important to you. You didn't go home during your time, did you?
I didn't go home until June the 7th, 1947. So I had two further years in what was a war service. We waited until the August when the war in Japan finished, but not until after the Hiroshima bomb had dropped. And then, I'm afraid to say, we all cheered like mad. And then we began to have thoughts when the second one was dropped in Nagasaki. But we were glad because the Japanese, we felt, would never have surrendered unless something like that had happened to them. They would have gone on. It was unthinkable that they should surrender. One of my best friends, who became my husband, Alan Hopkins, he was at the time on his way to the Far East in a cruiser. He landed in Sydney on the very day that the bomb dropped. And then after a few months of swanning around in Australia, the cruiser did a flag-waving tour of the Far East. So you name it in the Far East, he went there. The personnel who had served longest, and they were either brought home, a lot of them had been in Germany and Italy and had a pretty tough time, and they were demobbed first, as was right. I think because it had taken so long to train wireless mechs and radar mechs as well, that they weren't in a hurry to get rid of us, but they were right to get rid of the men who had served, as I've said. But the time went on and on and on, and the joys of service, like I must say, became a little bit stale by the end. I'm sure I blotted my copybook in more than one way. They used to publish the demob number every month. One got very, very anxious knowing that the number was coming up. It did at last come up. It came up in May that I was to be demobbed.
Now, I said I'd take you back to the beginning because I discovered that you had been to Buckingham Palace You mentioned VE Day.
Yes.
As a day you remember very vividly war experience. Tell me what happened. Why were you at Buckinghamshire?
Well, my three children, unfortunately, Judith died. She would have been included, I'm sure. My three children heard the advertisement on the radio. And so they contacted the British Legion, and a wonderful woman called Emma became our chief correspondent, and everything fell in place from there. And then they said, would you like to go to Buckingham Palace? So I thought, in for a penny, in for a pound. I said, yes, I'd love to. I'd never having been there. And so I did, to the tea party. David organised a limousine to take Catherine and me there, and we went to a hotel, and they took us to the palace in small coaches. There were about 50 of us, I think. And then we were led onto the terrace, which is below the balcony. You know, the king and the royal family were all there. The crowds and the parade had come up the mall. And then we saw the flypast just above us, straight over us, and that was thrilling. And then afterwards, we went into a long, like a reception room, a rather plain room, but it was laid out with very, very long table, too. And they had white tablecloths and food placed at intervals and told, you know, just sit down, sit where you like. And so we did. Very soon after that, the king and the queen and the prince and princess, Princess Anne and her husband, and Prince George, they all came in. We were not asked to stand. There was no trumpeting, nothing. It just came in and started to mix at once. Also came in without any announcements. The top four, I think, of the government, Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and again, no announcements when they came in. Nobody had to stand or salute or whatever. And then after that, the heads of all the armed forces came in. I might say that amongst the guests, I loved this part, amongst the guests, there were people who served in the forces. Evacuees, fire watchers, firemen, policemen, air raid wardens, people who worked on balloons and so on. Everybody had been contacted by the British Legion, and those who'd responded were there. And we all sat at these tables, and I realised soon that I was on the wrong side of the table because I was looking at Prince George sitting there just opposite. You couldn't speak to them across the table because that wouldn't have been polite. A little while later, an equerry came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, Her Majesty the Queen would like to speak to someone who served in the armed forces, a lady who worked in the armed forces. So did you? I said, yes, I was a WAF. And so she said, would you be prepared to do it? I said, of course. And then Queen Camilla came, and my daughter stood up and stood behind me, and then she sat down and held out her hand, which I touched, and I said, it's an honour, Mom. And she said, no, no, the honour is mine to meet those who served during the war. So tell me about yourself. We talked for, it seemed ages, and it was about 5 or 10 minutes. For a long time, and had the feeling she'd have gone on, really, but her equerry came and said it was time she moved on. And then after that, I had a long conversation with his name, I think, was Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, who was the head of the Air Force. Well, I mean, he was charming, and there was no ceremony, no sitting to attention or anything like that, if you could sit to attention. But he again was very, very interested, particularly interested in the fact that I had been influenced by the Junior Air Corps, thinking how important now the ATC is. And also he asked the same things that the Queen had most interested. And then we met a Rear Admiral who was called Timothy Lawrence. And my daughter, who seems to know about these things, says, he's Princess Anne's husband. We did have an interesting and humorous chat for some time with him. And the whole day was just lovely. It was such a happy day. And to me, being in that room with people from the king and the head of the forces and the head of the government, all there, and us, the hoi polloi, all there. And that's what democracy is. That's what we fought for.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Caroline, Lucy, Bob and Sarah, for reading the news, the Hearts Advertiser for providing it. Thanks to John and Wendy for the radio listings, our friends at Wharfdale Talking News for the audio-described TV listings, TNF Soundings for 10 Today, and the Wildlife Sound Recording Society for their evocative recordings. David read the events in history, and Sue presented famous birthdays. Special thanks to Rob and the remarkable Olga Hopkins. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in May 2025.
Smile, though your heart is aching.
We close with Smile, sung here by Nat King Cole. Would you be surprised to hear that it was originally written by none other than Charlie Chaplin? I hope you enjoy it. And remember to let us know about music you'd like to hear on our programmes. Goodbye for now, and keep well.
And sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. Light up your face with gladness. Hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear maybe ever so near, that's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you smile. That's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.